Before we start, just a bit of housekeeping. So today is the last session before Pesach, and the second of the mini Pesach series that we'll be doing. After Pesach, we're not going to have Shirim the first week after Pesach. To be honest, I'm just going to take a break. But then the issue is the following. Then we're going to have a once-off topic the following week, which is the 8th of May. The reason why I'm saying it like that is because the 1st of May, I mean. First of May, we'll have a once-off topic. The 8th of May, I'm away. I'm actually joining today. We have a bunch of rabbis, so I think 20 of us that are going to Israel for a week on a mission, which is really nice. So I'll be there from the 4th of May to the 11th of May. So the 8th of May, I'm going to be away. And therefore, the proper new series will start on the 15th of May. So we'll do one on the 1st of May on just a one-off topic. 8th of May, I'm away. 15th of May, we'll start the new series. I don't know what the name of the new series is, but I will tell you what I'm working on. I've discovered recently a fascinating book, or two actually, that is based on the works of Viktor Frankl, stuff that's not in Man's Search for Meaning. And also I discovered on YouTube fascinating videos and interviews of Dr. Viktor Frankl, which I didn't know existed. So I'm going to do the series on stuff from Viktor Frankl, of course, looking at Jewishly as we always do, but I think it'll be very fascinating. I listened a little bit already, and I think it's time to bring him back. the world's actually gone completely away from Viktor Frankl's words. And interestingly enough, he complains about, I'll get into it in the series, but he complains about the world and the culture that was there just before he started his work. And it's actually very prophetic. It's much of the same stuff that is happening now. So I think it will be an amazing series, I hope. So that will start on the 15th of May. And as I said, 1st of May will just go one-off topic, and 8th of May I'm away. Okay. So last week we mentioned that in the Haggadah we say three things that are very important to talk about and explain. That is the Pesach, the Paschal lamb that was brought in the temple, Matzah and Maror. The great Rabbi Gamliel said that if you don't explain these things, you haven't really fulfilled the mitzvah properly of the night. So last week we talked about the Paschal lamb, the whole idea of coming out of Egypt, being the idea of us becoming a nation that is one, connected to each other, and yet without diluting the individuality. We talk about the lamb being a weak animal, that if it hurts in one place, it hurts an entire lamb, and all different laws of the Paschal lamb and so on. So that we covered last week. This week I want to talk about Matzah and Maror, but I'm also going to extend it to the other feature of the Seder, which is the four cups of wine, and give a bit of insights. Also, first, a bit of general knowledge, because you know the Seder is really amazingly deep and amazing. It's a fantastic experience if we tap into it properly. So I'll go through that. So I'll go through some of the understanding, just the general knowledge of it, and then share with you some deeper ideas. Before I go on, before I start, just one of the, I'll talk about it again towards the end, but one of the big mitzvahs, and hopefully you'll appreciate it even more by the end of today, one of the big mitzvahs of the Seder night and how we connect to the energy of the Seder night and the power of the Seder night is to fulfill the mitzvah of eating matzah. And on the night of the Seder, that has to take place with Shmura Matzah. And it has to be a big piece. It has to be a big piece, at least once. Right. When I say a big piece, you know those round matzahs? So the round hand-baked matzahs, it's about just over a quarter of a matzah, preferably a third of a matzah. So it's because the piece, you're supposed to eat it like within a certain short time frame, like 7 minutes, not to stagger it over the night, but to eat it once, and that's the mitzvah, right? So if anyone doesn't have Shmura Matzah, doesn't have enough Shmura Matzah to give a big piece to everyone at the Seder, please let me know, and I'll organize it for you.
Are you sending a bread?
Uh-huh. We have it, just let me know if you need it, I'll organize it for you. Yes, no problem. Call me afterwards, I'll leave it now. Okay. So, starting with the matzah, What is the definition of matzah, first of all? And everyone knows matzah doesn't rise, chametz rises. What does that mean, right? So first of all, the definition of matzah is that it's got to be made, it's flour that must be from one of the five grains. The Talmud talks about the five grains that makes bread, that is considered halachically bread, right? And that is wheat, barley, spelt, rye, and oats. Okay. Now, generally speaking, matzah is made out of wheat, and the east spelt matzah as well. You can get shmura spelt matzah. The problem is, obviously, I'll just mention this in passing, someone is celiac and completely intolerant of gluten, so that's a problem. Now, they sell in the store what they call gluten-free matzah. That's very nice, and it's very tasty, but it's nothing to do with the first line. You can't fill the mitzvah with that, because it wasn't made one of the five grains. The only solution for someone who is very gluten intolerant, if they want to fulfill the mitzvah of matzah on Pesach night, is to eat oat matzah. Oat doesn't have gluten. You know, in Australia, it's not recommended because it grows near gluten. So it really doesn't have any gluten, and eating one piece of matzah, oat matzah on the same night will be fine. But so if anyone is celiac, I am getting a little bit of oat matzah. It tastes really horrible, and it's very, very expensive for some reason. But it's the way to do the mitzvah. So, you know, we inconvenience ourselves to do a mitzvah sometimes, okay. It's wheat, barley.
Yeah.
We know when it makes matzah and barley, but it is the 5 grains of wheat, barley, spilt, rye, and oats. So barley and rye, I've never seen barley matzah or rye matzah, but normally it's wheat. Lately, in the last number of decades, they started making a lot of spelt matzah, shmur matzah, and they make a limited amount of oat matzah, those people who really can't eat gluten.
The shmura is made out of fish, right?
One of the five.
So shmura is not necessarily one of
the five. No, shmura means, the word shmura means two things. The shmura matzah you eat at the Seder night has two features to it that makes it shmura matzah. First of all, it's handmade normally. I mean, you could get machine shmura, but the word shmura actually means it's been supervised right from the time it's harvested to make sure the wheat doesn't come into any contact with any water. And also, it's made for the mitzvah. If you ever visit a hand-baked matzah bakery, which you'll notice as groups of people set up a whole in a very interesting system, you can Google it to see how shmura matzah is made, hand-baked matzah. But there's a whole group of women normally, or bacharim, or sometimes like a song, who roll the matzah. There's someone that kneads the matzah, someone that puts it in the oven, every stage of the way. And you'll notice every time they start a new cycle, like every 18 minutes, the mashgiach, the supervisor, will stop everyone and say, everyone repeat after me, l'shem mitzvat matzah. And we're doing this for the sake of the mitzvah of matzah. Yeah. There's certain things that have to be done intentionally, and if it's not done intentionally, it doesn't work. I mean, it's matzah, it's not chometz, but you can eat it on Pesach, but it's not for the mitzvah. So that's what the shmura matzah, those are the features. It's normally handmade, it's supervised, and it's made for the mitzvah, right? So normally it's made out of wheat, but they can make shmura spelt, and they make shmura oats also if someone really needs. Wouldn't recommend, if you don't need, I wouldn't recommend oat matzah. But if you do need, you can get it. Okay. Now, why does it have to be made one of these five grains? I mean, you can see with the gluten matzah, it's possible to make it out of other things, right? So here's an interesting idea, just philosophically. Matzah, the idea of matzah is that it doesn't rise, right? And we know, we've talked about this many times, it's a symbol of humility as opposed to chametz, which does rise and ferments and it rises and so on. The definition of rising means fermenting. It's not actually that it's big. You can make a cake out of matzah meal, but it means a certain fermentation process that causes it to bloat, in other words, and to rise, which makes it chametz, right? Matzah has to be made out of the five grains because it's only these five grains that can potentially become chametz. In other words, you've got to make it, if you made it from
Quinoa,
for example, yeah. Right? If you make it from quinoa flour or almond flour, you can make matzahs out of any flour, but it's not potentially chametz. It can't rise. You can leave it for 3 hours and it won't rise, right? Why does matzah have to be made specifically from something that can become chametz? The whole idea of matzah is that you work on your ego, right? You work on lessening the ego. You work on really ruling the ego. You work on the idea of surrender and so on, as we'll talk about a bit later. And the idea is there's no point of absence of ego if there's not potential ego, right? Mm. We're not angels. The whole idea is that we're supposed to be people who have an ego, right? Which we all do. And we work on it, and we get rid of the chametz. We try to minimize the ego, and we connect with the matzah, which is the absence of ego, the getting rid of the ego, as we experience personal freedom and we experience the personal journey of Pesach. So matzah has to be made very quickly and very carefully, because it can't be chametz. But specifically, the idea is you have to be careful. In other words, you're a person that could have ego, you have potential ego, you have ego, and therefore you are working with it to get rid of it. But if a flower that can't rise altogether, then it's not, then it's an angel. In other words, it's not a person. Right? That is, yeah. That's be something that could, has a danger of ego, and yet you control it. Right? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So obviously the matzah doesn't rise because it's made very quickly with 18 minutes and all kinds of precautions that are made and so on and so forth, but it's potentially can become from it. That's the concept. Okay. Now, just a bit of general knowledge, I thought, because we're all sitting down to a say that it's, you know me, I always talk about this, we've got to advance from the reasons that we learned in primary school or kindergarten. So let's go into a little bit, just technically and general knowledge wise, why do we have three matzahs on the Seder? Huh? Anyone else? Sure. Three matzahs, why? Right? So here's many, there's lots of reasons, but here's four reasons. First is a very interesting halachic reason. Just purely on halachic grounds, a very interesting process how we arrived at three matzahs. And that is the following. Every Chag and every Shabbat, we have two challahs, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, Pesach, of course, it's not a challah, so it's a matzah. That's the same idea, right? It's something you wash on and make a motzi and so on. So Pesach would be no different. If you sat down to a regular Yom Tov meal on Pesach, you would have two matzahs, like you have every festival, right? Now, the halakha with the two challahs, for example, on Friday night, right? You know how you buy two challahs in a bakery, that they never come sliced, right? There's a good reason for that. Because halachically, when you make the blessing on a Friday, not during the week, you can have sliced, not a problem. But on a Shabbos or a festival, when you make a bracha on the two challahs, they're supposed to be two complete challahs, right? Two complete challahs. And you cut them, you make the blessing and then you cut them. That's the idea. It's considered special when you make a bracha over something complete and whole. And that's why on Shabbos and Yom Tov particularly, we're very careful to do that, right? So you need that on Pesach, so you need two complete matzahs. The problem is that we have a different aspect of matzah on Pesach night. That is that we know that matzah is something that has to be on the table at the beginning of the Seder, because when you tell the story and you ask the questions and all that, it's supposed to be when the matzahs are on the table, right? But which matzah? We know that matzah also is something called lechem oni, bread of affliction, or poor man's bread. And the Talmud says that a poor man's bread, a poor man never has a complete loaf. Therefore, to make the matzah into real poor man's bread, it has to be a broken piece of matzah, right? So that's a problem, because you can't take one of the two whole matzahs and break it. So what do? We put a third matzah. Mm-hmm. And just before we start the Haggadah, we break the middle matzah, mm-hmm. right? So that we still have two complete matzahs, plus a broken piece of matzah to fulfill this idea of poor man's bread on the table. Now, what's the significance of poor man's bread? We'll get to it, because it's a very important idea. But, okay. That's one reason. The other reason is that on Pesach night, we reflect a lot on our foundation, on where we come from, and of course, the foundation of the Jewish nation, because Pesach, at the end of the day, is the birth of the Jewish nation, really. That's when we became a nation, as we talked about last week. But we always reflect on our roots. What are our roots? Our roots are the three patriarchs and the four matriarchs, right? So Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and the four mothers, which are known as Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah, right? So therefore on Pesach night, we have three matzahs for the three patriarchs and four cups of wine for the four matriarchs. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
Now one day we'll do a shiur why the matzah has the three and the wine has the four, but not for today. Okay. The other one is talking about Abraham Avinu. We know the story of when Yitzchak was born, three angels arrived at Abraham, right? The story was Abraham had a circumcision, he was 99 years old, and he passed that test, and he circumcised himself as God had asked him to, and God wanted him to recuperate, so he made it very hot so there wouldn't be any guests, there wouldn't be any travelers. And Avraham Avinu was distressed, and he sat at the opening of the tent waiting for guests, because that was, Avraham Avinu always needed to have guests. So God sent him the three angels incognito, they looked like human beings, yeah. And they came, right? And then they turned out to be angels, and each one had a different function, and one of them gave the news to Avraham that in a year's time he was going to have a child, and that was Yitzchak. When that happened, you read in the Torah, Abraham was really excited, And he ran to Sarah's tent. And he said, quick, take 3 measures of flour and make what? Make bread. But the terminology in the Chumash in the Torah is asi ugot, make ugot, which in modern Hebrew means cake, but not in classical Hebrew. Ugot actually means matzahs. Mm. Why do we make matzah? It didn't taste exactly as our matzah, it was made differently in those days, but it's still matzah. Because we have a tradition that our patriarchs and our matriarchs were very spiritually sensitive and they understood the Torah before it was given. And even though the story of the Exodus of Egypt hadn't happened yet, but never, even then, Pesach had a certain energy of Pesach, just like it has now. It only historically happened once, but every year, even before and after, it still had the holiness and the energy of Pesach. Avraham Avinu was sensitive to that, and therefore he only ate matzah on Pesach, because he kept the Torah. And therefore when the angels arrived, they arrived on Pesach. And when they said, next year you will have a child, according to most opinions, that's what happened. Yitzchak was born on Pesach, a year later. So because it was Pesach, he ran to Sarah and said, please take 3 measures of flour, because there were three visitors, and make ugot, which means make matzah. And therefore on Pesach night, because that's when it all happened, we also have 3 matzahs to remember the 3 measures of flour that Sarah used in order to make the matzah. Mm. Right? In case you're wondering, in those days, people were experts at making matzah, and people used to make matzah in their own kitchen. We don't do that anymore because we don't know what we're doing. Right? So we have to get the board matzah. But people used to make matzah in their own home. Okay.
So, Rabbi, why did they say that, you know, we eat matzah because they didn't have time for the bread to rise when they were leaving Egypt? You'll say it's already tradition before.
Correct. And not only that, I'll wait a few minutes, I'll make your question bigger. Okay? It's a good question. Okay. I mean, that did happen, that they were rushing out and they couldn't rise, but there was the idea of matzah out of that. We'll see in a second. Okay. So 3 things. That was my next point. So then also we eat 3 matzahs for a different reason. Because actually, even though it is true that when they left Egypt, they were in a big rush and they couldn't bake proper bread, right? But they ate matzah before that. And in fact, there are 3 times, 3 different circumstances. I'm not talking about our patriarchs now, I'm talking about even the Jewish people that left Egypt. There were 3 different circumstances that ate matzah. We always said they ate matzah because they couldn't rise because they were in a rush, right? But actually, it's not exactly what happened. First of all, according to one of the great sages of, I think it was 13th, 14th century, the Ibn Ezra, he says that they actually ate matzah while they were enslaved in Egypt. Why? So he explains in the following way. Ibn Ezra was a traveler, he traveled a lot of places, and he said, when I was in India, he says, he didn't live in India, but he traveled to India once, and he saw a community of slaves or something, or prisoners. He said, I saw that they feed matzah to slaves and prisoners because it takes longer to digest and they can save on feeding the prisoners food. Right? They have to feed them less. Mm-hmm. So he says, that's what happened in Egypt, right? That's what happens in Egypt. And that the Yidden were actually quite used to matzah because the Egyptians would feed them matzah as slaves because it didn't rise. And it was easy for them and you had to give it less often, right? And that explains something we say in the Haggadah. There's a very puzzling sentence in the Haggadah, even before the Manishtana, there's an Aramaic paragraph where we say, Halach ma'anya, this is the bread of affliction that our forefathers ate in Egypt. Mm. If you go by the classic reason, they didn't eat it in Egypt and it wasn't bread of affliction. Mm. They ate it on the way out of Egypt, or whatever, right? But he says, no, they actually ate it in Egypt as slaves. And at that time, it was bread of affliction. In other words, it was bread because they were slaves, right? So that's the first context that the Jews ate matzah. The second time, this is really interesting, we say that they left the next morning and they were in a rush and they couldn't rise. But actually, the night before the Jews left Egypt, God instructed them to have a Seder. The first Seder as a nation was the night before they left Egypt, right? Because God said, you're going to leave in the morning, in the middle of the night, there's going to be the plague of the firstborns. Pharaoh, I'm telling you now that Pharaoh this time is going to agree and he's going to kick you out. But you will not leave in the middle of the night, because God wanted them specifically to leave in public, in daytime, in full view of everyone watching. But he said that the night they should all gather in their homes, that was when they put the blood on the doorposts, that Hashem would jump over the houses and not kill the Jewish firstborns and so on. And they should eat a paschal lamb, and they should eat it with matzah and maror. So there was a kind of a say that. I mean, they didn't tell the story, they hadn't experienced the story yet, but they gathered together to do these things, ready to leave the next morning, right? So, and that night, they ate matzah in preparation for freedom. So that was the second part of matzah, context of matzah. And the third is the story we say in Haggadah, that the next morning, Paro kicked them out. They were in a big rush, and God told them they must rush out, they must go quickly. They must go during the day, but they must go quickly. And therefore, they baked bread for the way, provisions for the way. Didn't have time to rise, so it turned out to be matzah. So because of those three different times they ate matzah, that's another reason why we have three matzahs on the Seder plate. Okay. Just to try to share with you, you can share that with your Seder, of why we eat three matzahs. Now, the question is, why do we use that reason then? Why do we say we eat matzah because they couldn't? That's, again, another discussion. That's because there's Kabbalistically, there's different levels of matzah. And when we eat matzah, the highest matzah, the highest level of matzah was when they left Egypt. That was the third time, and that's the matzah we eat. That's also connected to that level, and that's why we use that explanation. Okay. Now, I want to share with you a deeper idea, but before I do that, I'm just going to share with you a little bit about the maror that we eat. Right? We eat bitter herbs. So, what vegetable is bitter herbs?
Horseradish.
Sorry, horseradish. So why do we eat lettuce? No. So why is it lettuce on the same thing? Okay. So very fascinating. Now, we're supposed to eat maror because we're supposed to remember the bitter times as well. This is part of our gratitude. It's always important to remember what we thank Hashem for, where we were, and what we came from to appreciate the great miracle of going out of Egypt and becoming Hashem's nation, right? Now, the Mishnah, how do we know what maror is? It can be anything. Maybe you can eat, a lemon, or something, right? Mm. But there's a Mishnah in the Talmud that lists the five different types of vegetables that qualify for maror. Okay? The problem is, we only know what the first two are. We don't know what the next three are. They're Aramaic names and they have names, but we don't know what they are. But we do know the first. The first is called chasad. That's in Hebrew, modern Hebrew. It's spelled differently. It's actually an Aramaic word, right? It comes from Aramaic. You know, many words in modern Hebrew come from Aramaic. I don't know if you know. Like, you know, he say, I don't care, lo ichpat li. No such word in Torah, ichpat. In classical Hebrew, it's not such a word. It's taken from the Gemara. It's taken from Aramaic in the Talmud, right? That's it. Many words like that. So. Chasa actually means lettuce. Now, more specifically, it's actually cos lettuce or main lettuce, they call it in America, right? And that's the first ingredient that the Mishnah says you can use for the mitzvah of eating bitter herbs. And the second is called tamcha, which is chrei, which is what we call horseradish, right? And the truth is you can do either of them to fulfill the mitzvah. Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't say in the Gemara anyway about chrei. It's called but in the Gemara it's called tamcha. Tamcha, that's what it's called. That's what they used to call it in Babylon of old. But it's horseradish. Some people have a custom just use lettuce, and that's fine. Some people maybe just use horseradish, and some people have a custom of mixing the two, right? Now, the truth is it makes more sense to use horseradish, because if you're talking about bitter herbs, horseradish is sharp, right? Lettuce is not that sharp. But there's two reasons that we use it, three reasons actually. One is two halachic reasons. First of all, it's the first one listed in the Mishnah, because the Mishnah lists that the first ingredient, maybe that's the preferable one, so we often use that. It's not really bitter, although the stalk is very bitter. And interesting, the commentaries explain like this, that lettuce is actually quite soft on the outside and actually a little bit sweet. It's actually not bitter. Suddenly you get to the stalk that it becomes very bitter, right? Yeah. If you peel away the leaves and you get to the stalk, that's a very bitter part. You don't have to eat that, but I'm saying that's bitter. Now, the truth is that that's also a symbol of the bitter time, because what actually happened in Egypt when Pharaoh enslaved the Jewish people, because the Jewish people multiplied very quickly and became a big nation, and he was getting very worried, so he started to make them more slaves. But how did he convince them to do that? So actually what happened was, he tricked them into it. He offered them employment. He offered them jobs, and he offered them building jobs and contracts and stuff like that. And once they started working, he took that away, and it was too late. Okay? So it was nice in the beginning, and then it became very bitter at the end. That's similar to lettuce, that is nice on the outside, but when you get to the core, it's actually quite bitter. And that's another reason why lettuce is is considered maror.
Yeah.
But also it goes back to the word that's used for lettuce in the Talmud, which I said before is chasa, and that comes from a Hebrew word chas. Chas means to have mercy and compassion. So we eat the maror, we remember the bitter times, but we also remember that God had compassion on us and he took us out of Egypt. Okay. That's just a little bit about maror. Now, let's go back to the matzah and understand the following. So we know that matzah, this thing I've said once before, but this matzah is about surrender. That's what it is. It's about positive surrender, right? It's complete humility. We know that Pesach is a reset. Pesach is the beginning of the Jewish cycle. And therefore it's the beginning of when we re-experience becoming a nation once again. We are God's people, we want to grow, we want to go out of our own personal Egypt, and so on. What's the foundation? The foundation is we really want to go out of our own personal prison. We have to have a paradigm shift, and we have to let go of ourselves, right? That's the ingredient. We have to completely let go of ourselves in order to connect to and to grow into something higher than ourselves. It's for this reason that the Maharal of Prague explains an interesting thing. Right, the great philosopher Maharal of Prague explains the following. We say, I explained to you before, halachically, why we need a broken matzah, because it's called poor man's bread, right? So the Maharal of Prague says, he doesn't understand. We know there are certain things, most things we do at the Seder, is to experience freedom. Wine, we lean, we have nice dishes, all those things are what we call to remember the chayrut, to remember the freedom, right? One or two things, like the matzah, like the maror, I mean, the bitter herbs, is to remember the slavery, right? But matzah is one of those things we eat to remember the freedom. The Jews were taken out of Egypt, they didn't have time to make bread, whatever the case is, but it's a symbol of freedom. She says, so why would it be called poor man's bread? Poor man's bread is a negative thing. Poverty is not a nice thing, poverty is a negative thing. And he explains a beautiful idea. He says, no. We don't mean poor man's bread in the context of negative poverty. He develops this idea, which I always call, he doesn't say this because it's not in English, but calls it positive poverty. What's positive poverty? He says matzah is poor man's bread because matzah means that you come as a clean slate. You let yourself go completely. Complete surrender, right? Because if we want to connect to something much higher than us and want to grow beyond ourselves, as long as we leave ourselves in the picture, then we're not really connecting to something else, right? It's a little bit like I explained actually last night at a Kayemesh, you know, Rosh Chodesh, right? We have Rosh Chodesh. How does Rosh Chodesh work in the Jewish cycle? It's the lunar cycle, right? So another way it works is we have the moon waxes and wanes, right? It's bigger and smaller. Towards the end of the month, it gets very, very small, and then it starts again. But the way it works is the moon goes very small at the end of the month, and actually there's a few hours where the moon is completely not visible. It disappears. And then it emerges again, right? Why does it have to be like that? Because the idea of Rosh Chodesh, and one of the great Kabbalists, the Shalah, says that when it comes to the month of Nisan, the whole month is like Rosh Chodesh, because that's the month we became who we are, right? This month of Pesach. When it comes to real growth, in order to grow and emerge with a complete renewal, you have to disappear first. Because if the moon would even have a slight sliver at the end of the month and just start growing again, it would be growth, but of the old moon. In other words, it's growth of who you were before. It's not something, it's not a paradigm shift, right? But if you want to have a real growth, if you want to reconnect in a completely different way, take a leap, a quantum leap in the area of the journey of growth, going out of our own personal Egypt, there has to be that idea of complete surrender. Let go of yourself completely. Says the Maharal, that's matzah. Matzah is not just a little bit letting go of the ego. Matzah is completely letting go of the ego. In other words, letting go of any sense of self and to say to God, listen, I'm yours. Now tell me what to do. And let me start the journey again. Let's be like the moon that disappears, and now we can start again. In a different context, in a different level, with a different perspective. Right? Is that clear? And that's what he says. That's the idea of positive poverty. A real person that's stricken with poverty means he doesn't have anything. When we come to matzah, we start the journey, the cycle, the Jewish cycle again on Pesach. That's how we start. We start with clean. I'm not mixing myself into this at all. so that I can really connect with something greater than me. By the way, that's also why, in the Zohar, the matzah is called bread of emunah. You know that? In fact, the Zohar says the first night is bread of emunah, the second night is bread of healing. Right? So, you know, in Judaism, everything's connected with the physical experience. It's an amazing thing. The matzah is actually holy. We eat matzah on Pesach night. We're eating emunah. We're connecting to emunah. I mean, obviously, it has to be intentional, but it's not just a cracker that we're eating, but it's actually, we're absorbing, we're ingesting emunah. What's the connection between these two ideas? Same thing. Emunah means, the definition of emunah means I'm connecting to something beyond my understanding. The highest level of the human consciousness is understanding, seichel, intellect. Emunah means I don't have any understanding. I'm just connecting to something far greater than me. I'm connecting to something far greater than my intellect, something that transcends my conscious thinking and my intellectual thinking infinitely higher than my thinking. And that's emunah. That's what it means. And in fact, our sages tell us that, you know, when the Jews left Egypt, they were very spiritually poor. They didn't have many mitzvot. They assimilated with Egypt. They didn't have much in terms of merits, right? So why were they taken out? One of the Midrashim says that the Jews were redeemed bizchut ha'emunah, in the merit of emunah, because they believed. Ultimately, they came around and they believed, they followed. And they followed God, as God himself says, there's a verse in the Tanakh, that God praises the Jewish people through one of the prophets and says, I praise this nation that followed me into the desert without knowing where they were going. A leap of faith, that's what it was. It made no sense, but they followed, right? Because that was emunah. And that's the beginning of the process. That surrender allows us to transition and to graduate from being locked in ourselves to connecting to something completely different. That's the first step of any real journey of growth. However, surrender itself is not enough. Right? Because at the end of the day, God created us, not to leave us behind. He created us. He created us. He created our mind. He created our emotions. He created our skill set. He created who we are. Every human being, every person is a whole structure of many, many components. So surrender is a very healthy first step so that we should rid ourselves of the ego, but the idea is not just to follow. The idea is not just to be a robot or a shmata. That's not the idea. God wants us to serve him with everything that we have, right? He wants us to serve him with our minds, with our emotions, with our action, with our understanding. He wants us to explore. He wants us to understand. He wants us to ask questions, which is the whole structure of the Seder, asking questions, right? He wants us to internalize. He wants us to get excited. He doesn't want us just to be a blind, robotic follower. That's not what he wants. Matzah is necessary, because otherwise everything that we have is all mixed in with our ego. So we've got to get rid of the ego, and we get rid of ourselves, and we come clean. But then we also have to understand, we have to explore, we have to feel, bringing back the different components of who we are to that process of getting involved, that we should be present, not just surrendered. And that is very much hinted in the four cups of wine. Four cups of wine, we know that in Kabbalah, wine is called bina, understanding. Because when a person, you know, we've talked about this many times, when you understand something, it's chokhmah and bina, right? Chokhmah means you get the idea, but you don't really fully understand it yet. Where does a person have real simcha, joy? When you understand something. So the idea of wine is the opposite of matzah. Wine has a taste, wine has an enjoyment. When a person drinks wine, they're very much there. They're very much part of the process, right? I mean, even eating matzah, forget about the matzah itself, it doesn't rise. Eating matzah generally is an act of surrender. I mean, it's not just a dry piece of flour or water and eat it like in 7 minutes and eat a big piece. That in itself is an act. It doesn't take, there's not much enjoyment in that, other than doing mitzvah, right? But wine is different. Wine, you're fully there. You're enjoying the process, right? Because four cups of wine is that next step, so to speak. I mean, even though we drink a cup in the Seder before the matzah, but that doesn't matter. That's the idea. Matzah is a biblical mitzvah. Wine came later. It's a rabbinic mitzvah. But so it's the second stage, in other words. So the first stage is emunah, surrender, matzah, poverty, positive poverty. The second stage is the wine. You've got to enjoy it. You've got to be part of the process. So I want to share with you an idea about the four cups of wine, because it's very much hinted, this idea, particularly in the fourth cup. So why do we drink four cups of wine, right? Why do we drink four cups of wine? Many reasons, I've told you one before, it's the four matriarchs and so on. But the reason that's the mainstream reason, and the reason that's relevant for this discussion, is you look at your handout, you'll see that after four cups of wine towards the end, in the Torah, there are four expressions of redemption. We mentioned this before, and I'll give you another take today. God says, I will take you out, I will take you out of affliction. I will save you from slavery. I will redeem you from Egypt. And then I'll take you as a nation. Right? So you look at the four, there's a difference between the first three, right? The first three and the fourth one. First three is what God is going to take us away from, correct? And the fourth one is what we are going to become. Yeah? So let's talk about the first three. And I'm going to share with you an idea, a very fascinating idea, I thought, which can be applied to our personal journey, that comes from the Kli Yakar. The Kli Yakar was a 16th century sage. He was a student of the Maharal of Prague, and later he succeeded him as the rabbi of Prague. He's buried in Prague. When I was in Prague a number of months ago, I was at his kever, at his graveside. He's buried not far from the Maharal. He was a student of his, but he was a great, very fascinating individual. And he wrote one of the most fascinating commentaries on the Torah, on the Chumash. And when the Torah talks about these four expressions, he gives the following idea. He gives it like an historic context, but I'm gonna sort of apply it a little bit to our own journey of how we go out of our own Mitzrayim. And he says the following: the Jews were in Egypt for 210 years, correct? So they were in exile, essentially, right? And in exile, he says, there are three layers of exile. What are the three layers of exile? Where did the Jews come from? They came from Israel, right? Abraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov were in Israel. The 12 tribes lived in Israel. That was where the nation was starting to take shape, and that's it. That was the homeland. It's been the homeland since Abraham, right? I know the world doesn't quite get this, but it has been our homeland since Abraham, right? But then God says to Abraham, there will come a time that your children, your descendants, will actually be spend some time in a foreign land, right? Which was Egypt. And eventually they'll come back to Israel, which they did after the desert, right? So says the Kayaka, the first layer of exile is just being in a foreign land. Just being in a land that's not yours, right? The fact that the Jews, even before they became slaves, even the fact that they were just there, they were out of home, they were not where they normally are. That's already one layer of exile. A worse layer of exile is that when people are in a foreign land, not only are they in a foreign land, but they become slaves there. And that's what happened to Jewish people. They became slaves. They had to work for Pharaoh, right? And a third layer of exile is, you know, sometimes you can have someone that's a slave, but he's treated reasonably okay. But we know that the Egyptians didn't just enslave the Jewish people. They actually afflicted them. They made them suffer. They tormented them, right, in various different ways. And we talk about it in the Haggadah, right, these three ways. So he says, if you look at the three, first three expressions of redemption, you'll see that it goes backwards. God says like this, why do you say three, I'm going to take you out, I'm going to redeem you. Why do you say it three ways? Because he says, this is, if you look at it carefully, this is how it works. He says, first of all, I'm going to take you out of the worst one. Right? You look at number A. It says, I will take you out of affliction. Number one, out of the worst layer of slavery. Second of all, I'm going to save you from slavery. That's the second. And then he says, I'm going to redeem you. I'm going to take you out of Egypt, and I'm going to take you out of your foreign land. So basically, God said three expressions of taking them out because he was taking them out of the three layers of exile. Now, as I've said so many times, when we sit down to the Seder, we experience Pesach, we have to reflect on going out of our own Egypt, right? Taking the next step towards a better person, better relationships, better relationship with God, better spirituality, better godliness, all these kind of things. Growth on all levels. What are the things that stand in the way of growth? We always talk about Mitzrayim as our own prison that stands in the way of growth, correct? But I want to take this idea of the Kuyaka and say that we can say the same three things is what prevents us from being, from properly growing, right? The first one is being in a foreign land. What does that mean? Being in a foreign land emotionally, in a psychological, emotional sort of context or spiritual context, it means I'm okay, but I'm just not connecting, right? In other words, like this. For example, sometimes a person can be in a relationship, but they're not there. They're there, but it's like remotely. It's like a foreign land. Or you can do a mitzvah. Someone can put up a mezuzah. Or someone can do kindness because it's an obligation. It's a duty. You've got to do it, but it's not their identity. They can make kiddush every Friday night, but it's just a thing you do. It's not their identity. It's not who they are, right? And that obviously prevents growth because you don't grow in something that you're not excited about. You don't grow in something you're not passionate about. You only grow in something that's you, that you identify with, right? So therefore, the first blockage to growth is just not connecting to what we're doing. We're doing good things maybe, but we're not connecting to it. It's like being in a foreign land. We're somewhere else. We're not there. We're not in the good things. We're just somewhere else. Our mind is somewhere else. Our heart is somewhere else, even though we're doing a lot of good things. Okay. That's first layer of excellence. The second is slavery. We become slaves. What does that mean? People are slaves. We become addicted or enslaved to our own temptations, to our own problems. Each one has their own sort of form of slavery. Some people are slavery to their indulgences. Some people are slavery to jealousy, to anger. They're slavery to creating an image. They're obsessed with always creating an impression with other people, right? And it just we all have a level of slavery with something that's hard to control, right? That's the way God designed us, that sometimes we just get so involved and so immersed in the things that we're pursuing. It might be slavery to pursuit of materialism or hedonism, whatever the case is. We all have our area of slavery. And of course, when that slavery gets bad, it becomes, again, a very strong blockage to grow. Because we can't grow, we can't be less angry because we're addicted to our anger. We can't live a life of meaning and purpose because we're addicted to hedonism. Or we can't, whatever the case is, we're just addicted to certain things. I don't mean addicted in the clinical sense. I mean, we're so connected, it's just hard for us to tear ourselves away from those things that are concealing the idea of meaning and purpose, that we're enslaved. We're not only not connecting, but we're more than not connected, we're actually enslaved in that foreign land. And the third layer of slavery is being tormented, affliction. What is that? And this is a very important idea. Why don't we grow sometimes? Because we're tormented with guilt and shame. Right? The worst thing that can prevent a person from growing is to have a negative self-image that I'm not able to grow. There's no hope. I've done this too many times. I failed too many times. I insulted that person and now I'm just done. I can't. Right? There's a famous little idea, I think, from one of the Hasidic rabbis. He says, you know, we all have the Yetzer Tov and the Yetzer Ra. We all have a good inclination and a bad inclination, right? But the bad inclination is called in Yiddish the klugimker, like the smart one, very cunning. Why is it very cunning? Your Yetzer Hara knows that he can get you to sin, but he can't get you to do terrible things. Well, these things that you know are terrible, right? No one sitting here, the Yetzer Hara is going to come to you, and you know what, I think you should go out and kill someone. You're not going to do it. He knows it's not going to be successful, right? So what does he do? What he does is this is what they explain. So he convinces a person to do something minimal, not as bad. And then it makes you feel bad about it. Right? When we do something wrong, that's not the problem. I mean, of course it's a problem. We shouldn't do anything wrong. But when we fail, you know, we get angry with someone. Okay, we're a human being, we did it. That's not such a problem. The bigger problem is feeling bad about it afterwards. Now, of course, we need to recognize, we have to take responsibility for it. And sometimes that means temporarily feeling a bit uncomfortable with what we did, so we can take responsibility and we can improve. But that's not the tactic. The tactic is to get us to feel depressed about it, upset about it, to ruminate in it, and just to say, you know what, it's all worth trying. And we go into a despair, we go into a feeling of just giving up hope, right? That is the worst barrier to growth. Once we lock ourselves into despair, we're done. Comes along God and says, listen, I'm going to take you out of Egypt. them up, but I'm going to take you out step by step. I'm going to take you out of the worst, the second worst, and then the least worst. The first, and this is, he's talking to us, not just talking to the Jewish people in Egypt. He's talking to us, and he's talking to us, says like this: you're coming to Pesach, you need to know three things. First of all, you need to get out of the being tormented. Afflicting yourself with the guilt and the shame and the depression and the sadness, because you need to understand that there's never such a thing that there's no hope. No, it doesn't work. God created human beings to fail, and the good news is that there's always a way back. Right? I think I explained this a while ago. That's the hay, the matzah, that little thing on top. You can always climb back in, right? So we need to get out, and this is what God is taking us. He's giving us the ability on Pesach to get out of that worst layer of slavery. You got safety. I'm going to take you out of the, I'm going to take you out of the affliction, which means I'm going to take you out. I'm going to allow you to work on yourself, to instill hope, never to give up, never to think that you're a bad person, because you're never a bad person, because you might have done bad things, but you're never defined by your weaknesses. You're never defined by your failures. Deep down, as we know, we all have a neshama, and that neshama is always pure. That soul is always pure, and that soul is always burning, and it's always a way back. There's always a way back to connect, no matter how low you would have fallen. Right? I once read this idea of Rabbi Twersky on Haggadah. He said, how come we have this vegetable at the beginning of Haggadah that we dip in salt water, right? He says, why a vegetable? Why not something else? I don't want a piece of fish. He says, because a vegetable grows in the ground. And we get taught at the very beginning of the Seder that vegetable which was deep in the ground, as we sometimes think we are also, we're so low down, suddenly at the Seder, it's a whole yichus, he's on the Seder table, and he's part of the Seder plate, right? This little vegetable is nothing. Suddenly he's a big part of the Seder. You're making a bracha on him, you're dipping in the salt water, and it's a big discussion, right? That's the lesson. Because the first layer of exile we take ourselves out of, that feeling of despair. The second thing we need to know is, that we have to take ourselves out of slavery. What does that mean? That we have to recognize that there's always hope, but we have a choice. And that choice is a choice of self-control. We should never think, unless it's a clinical thing, that's something else and it needs different intervention, but we all have our little areas of slavery. We need to know that at the end of the day, we're not bound by it. We're not governed by it. We can make a choice. We can slowly, step by step, get a little bit less angry, be a little bit more nicer, do a bit another mitzvah. We can do things that are hard for us, but it's a choice. At the end of the day, it's a choice. And we have that free choice. And it's fundamental to Judaism that we have a choice to choose to do right. We have a choice not to get angry. We have a choice not to be jealous. We have a choice to do good things. It's a choice. And therefore, we need to take ourselves out of being defined as a slave. We shouldn't think, I'm a slave to those vices. I'm a slave to those temptations. We can come out of the slavery. And then God tells us the third cup. If you really want to go out of Egypt, you have to connect. You can't be in a foreign land. You've got to do good things, but get involved in them. Understand them. Learn about them, as we always talk about. Appreciate their significance. Get excited about them. Right? Don't be in a foreign land. You're doing good things, that should become you. Get excited about it so it becomes your land. Not that you were somewhere else in a foreign land. Those are the three things that are the foundation of Yetziat Mitzrayim, our personal exodus, going out of these three layers of exile. But God says that all leads to the fourth cup, and the fourth cup is the most important. Fourth cup, God says, I don't want to just take you out of slavery. I don't want to just take you out of affliction. I don't want to just take you out of a foreign land. I want you to become my nation. I want to have a relationship with you. And in that relationship, we're talking about on the wine, right? And going back to what I said in the beginning, in that relationship, you have to be present. You have to get involved. It's got to be almost like a partnership. Not exactly a partnership. God always remains God. But he wants us not just to be passive. I don't want you to be robots and grow as robots. I want you to grow as a cup of wine. I want you to grow with understanding, with passion, with enthusiasm. But I don't want you just to go out of not doing bad things. I don't want you just to be away from slavery. I want you to be involved. And that's why that's such an important step after the matzah. The pathway to this growth is you got to start with matzah. It's got to be total surrender. Otherwise, we'll remain stuck. We'll remain stuck in our temptations and our egos and our shame and our guilt and all the stuff. So we've got to just reset. Total surrender. But total surrender cannot remain as total surrender. Responsibility means that we're not present. God says the fourth cup is you need to become my nation. You need to become a people that are present. You're involved. You're thinking. You're asking questions. You're learning. Yes, you're doing them with smart, but you're understanding them and you're exploring them. You're being kind to others, but you're doing them with simcha, with joy. You're understanding the significance of it. You really make room for others. You're building up empathy, compassion. You're doing it. You're present. And that's the fourth cup of wine. And that's the secret to the Seder. The secret to the Seder is, of course, we have to eat the matzah. That's step one. We eat the matzah, we inculcate emunah. We try to get rid of our ego a little bit. But then we also remember the four cups of wine of getting rid of the ego, but then being present at the same time, in the context of humility, but being present and really enjoying the process. I want to just in the last 3 minutes just share with you a beautiful idea. Just as a parting thought for Seder, I think, because it's also very important to the time we're in now. I mentioned before that matzah is the idea of emunah, right? Emunah means one of the foundations of Judaism is we all have always believed and believed in hope and believed in our eternal destiny, both individually and collectively. But part of the hallmarks of emunah, I think this is such an important thing to think about now as well, as we wait in anticipation for everything to come to a good close, right? To remember that part of emunah is not giving up. Not saying, well, I've had emunah for so long and, you know, it's coming a little bit too much already. So I once heard, I might have shared with you many years ago, I don't remember, but it's a beautiful little story, analogy. They tell a story, right? Because we need to know that we never give up, and right now, for sure, we can't give up. So they tell a story of two beggars who came to a shtetl, right? Two non-Jewish beggars, and they were very hungry, and they were looking for a meal. And they knocked on a door, looked like a house that was would have a decent meal. And they knocked on the door, and the host opened up and welcomed them in. And what they didn't know is that it was Seder night. But they were welcomed in, and they said, we're given two places at a table, and they see beautiful dishes and wine, and they go, oh, this is going to be a meal. Right. Okay, so that everyone gets a cup of wine. These guys are starving hungry. They drink a cup of wine. And then they say, Yiddish, mehektan, they start. First, a little vegetable. This is not exactly what they're looking for, a little bit of parsley. I mean, you know, like that. Okay, they say it must be some sort of thing they do. And go, people want to wash their hands, they buy, like, okay. And then they start to speak. Speaking, telling stories, vices, right? And these guys are saying they're starving. Eventually they get up and they wash their hands again. They say, okay, maybe this time we'll be followed with a proper meal, right? And they give everyone this cardboard, like this tasteless piece of stuff. Okay, they eat it, but they really want a meal.
Yeah.
Okay, I think maybe now, maror, bit of herbs, piece of lettuce, horseradish, they taste terrible. No, meal coming. So they start passing out a matzah sandwich. Oh, they're giving us the cardboard and the bit of herbs. One guy gets fed up, runs out of the house, and says, I can't take it. See what I'm saying? Yeah. Next day he meets his friend, and his friend tells him, you're such a fool.
Yeah.
If you'd have waited 5 minutes, 5 more minutes, you had a meal like you've never seen in your life. And I say the story because, you know, we had a long exile, and we're still in this exile. In fact, sorry, so look what we're going through now with Israel and so on and so forth. We can't give up hope.
Yeah.
So we have to hang on there because it's about to come a beautiful meal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's emunah. Emunah means we don't give up. And it's what you learn from the Seder. You don't give up. The meal will come. And will come soon in Mitzvah Hashem. We're hopefully almost there.
Uh-huh.
We shouldn't be a fool like that beggar who runs out just before the meal comes. Right? Yeah. But we don't want Mashiach to come and then say, oh, we didn't have faith. We actually gave up hope before he came. No. We're never going to give up hope.
Yeah.
It's coming. The victory's coming. Bezrat Hashem, everything in Israel is going to come to a positive close. And ultimately, we're going to be married to the ultimate redemption. Redemption through Mashiach will come very soon. So, Chag Sameach, everyone, again. Again, if you need Shmur Matzah, so you have enough Shmur Matzah for all people to say that.
Yes.
Such an important mitzvah, please let me know. And I'll arrange with you. And just have a Chag Sameach. And we'll resume afterwards. We'll have one session before I have to go to the podcast.